sun is setting, the heat has broken, the sky is a soft rose color, and you have an itch. Several itches, in fact. Mosquitoes tend to show up when the day cools, and they can be mighty annoying. But annoying is just a hint of what mosquitoes can do and have done to human beings through history. The very course of history has been altered several times by the diseases carried by mosquitoes. We get a comprehensive look at the relationship in the new book, The Mosquito, A Human History of Our Deadliest Predator, by Timothy C. Weingard. Tim is a professor of history and political science at Colorado Mesa University in Grand Junction. His specialties are military history and indigenous studies, and he's the author of four previous books. Timothy Weingard, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
So how did military history and indigenous studies lead you to the mosquito?
Well, as both my prior books dealt with aspects of both, until the First World War, roughly 65% of casualties in any war were caused by disease and not any man-made invention or weapons. So disease has played a far greater role in shattering armies than bullets or bombs. And then obviously with what they refer to as the Columbian Exchange, which was the global transference of ecosystems and biology across the world with Columbus in the ensuing colonization of Europeans around the globe, non-immune indigenous peoples all over the world, but in the Americas, suffered horrific death rates, upwards of perhaps 95% of the population from European diseases, whether that be smallpox, influenza, tuberculosis, and obviously malaria, and then eventually yellow fever. So there was a connection between both the research I had done in my books prior with indigenous peoples globally, and then also with the military history aspect as well. So it was a pieces of the puzzle that were slowly put together. And obviously the question I get asked the most is, why mosquitoes? Like, how did you come up with this topic? And it wasn't, I wasn't laying in bed one night and just kind of went, hey, mosquitoes. It wasn't quite that simple. It was a matter of a slow progression of putting pieces of the larger historical puzzle together, and then kind of coming to the conclusion that, wow, this tiny little animal that has shadowed the, you know, our existence as human beings and her diseases has punched way above her weight class across humanity.
And you say her because, and you know, I don't know if this causes any relief for people, but only the females bite.
Only the females bite, yes. The females need blood from humans or other animals to grow and mature her eggs, and the males don't bite. The male's world predominantly revolves around nectar and sex.
Well, so they get to eat and they get to have sex, and that's pretty much the whole existence of the male mosquito?
They get to drink their nectar and help procreate, and that's their role.
Okay, yeah, you just lie but there.
But I think they get off easy in the whole scheme of things because, you know, the females bite and everybody hates them and they transmit all these diseases, and so they're, you know, they're the most wanted criminal on the planet.
Well, truly, and this is the thing, that they still manage to do unbelievable damage considering it's just half the species that does that. How many people die from mosquito-borne diseases over a given year?
The statistics vary across a wide range, and there's no consensus of exact numbers. And obviously all the numbers that are out there are estimates because we don't know, because predominantly what we're seeing is malaria is the biggest killer, and so some of the rural areas in Africa and Southeast Asia where malaria takes its greatest toll, the numbers aren't reported and we don't know, but from all mosquito-borne diseases, not just malaria, you know, roughly 700,000-ish, maybe a bit more per last year per year in recent years.
And how does that compare to, example, the deaths of people caused by other people?
The average, again, these are estimates, give or take, is somewhere around 475,000, 500,000 a year from other human beings. And we as humans are number two as a killer, excuse me, of our own species. But the mosquito, it, regardless of what the range in the estimates are, the mosquito is still the greatest, or the diseases she transmits are the greatest killer of human beings.
Which gets us back to the subtitle of the book, A Human History of Our Deadliest Predator. This is indeed our deadliest predator. Gives it tremendous power throughout history as you make a convincing case. You do say, Timothy, the mosquito doesn't kill, the diseases do. But what do you mean when you say that the diseases exist because of mosquitoes?
Well, the mosquito flying solo, if you will, untethered from a pathogen is harmless. We would still get the itch and the little bit of swelling because that's caused by the anticoagulant in her saliva that she's pumping in while she's drawing the blood. But that in itself is not deadly. It's a nuisance and an annoyance, and none of us particularly enjoy it, but, you know, we could live with that. Essentially, the pathogens have used the mosquito to hitch a ride to continue their procreation and their transference. So they use the mosquito to invade other species. So, for example, the malaria parasite, part of its reproductive cycle happens in the mosquito, but another part of its reproductive cycle happens in an animal host. So it could be humans, but it could be other animals as well, because malaria affects numerous animals, different kinds of malaria than the human kinds. But so it's a very sophisticated parasite, the malaria parasite. So if we, without the mosquito, these viruses and the parasite of malaria or filariasis, the worm that causes the very grotesque, if you will, engorgement of limbs, or elephantiasis in the common vernacular, they wouldn't be able to spread or continue the cyclical contagion without the mosquito transportation, if you will.
Let's come to the biological why, Timothy. Why do mosquitoes need our blood?
The female needs the blood of humans or other animals to grow and mature her eggs. So when she bites, she needs the protein content, obviously, and it immediately starts excreting the water content from the blood because it's such a huge weight for such a tiny animal. So when she bites, she immediately excretes the water and finds a vertical surface, and then with the aid of gravity continues to condense the blood and excrete the water. It's actually quite an amazing feeding and sophisticated feeding ritual.
That really is. That's a really efficient animal. But and then, who is most likely to get bitten among humans? Is the blood type story true?
Yes. There's generally roughly 85% of your mosquito seducing charm or not charm is pre-wired in an individual's genetic circuit board. So, for example, type O blood is her vintage of choice over types A and B or their blend. And it depends on the natural chemical and bacterial levels in and on people's skin, which includes lactic acid. Another one is how much carbon dioxide an individual respires. Carbon dioxide, it magnetizes mosquitoes. The bacteria on our feet are mosquito aphrodisiac. So there's various biological components of an individual that make a person less appealing or more appealing to mosquitoes. But at the end of the day, because she needs the blood to procreate and reproduce and carry on her species, she'll find the chink in our armor or any exposed, Achilles heel, if you will, and find that exposed target of opportunity. We've all doused ourselves in bug spray and DEET, and as we all know, we can forget or miss one little tiny spot, and you know, she seems to find it. So there are various components that go into it, but most of it is our biology.
Wow. As you point out, they've been around a long time. That mosquitoes bothered dinosaurs as well. But love the description about what elephants are able to do as a defense against mosquitoes. How do they handle mosquitoes?
Well, obviously, elephants are in Africa, which is the ancestral birthplace of malaria and other yellow fever and other mosquito-borne disease. So they can't reach spots on their back with their tail or their trunk. So when mosquitoes land on their back, they can fold the skin on their back sort of like an accordion and crush the mosquitoes in between these skin folds.
Well, if we can think of genetic modifications for humans, this is something to consider down the road. No, I
Well, with CRISPR, we may be able to do that.
True. Is there one disease of all those that are borne by mosquitoes that is of more concern than the others?
Well, throughout our human odyssey, malaria has been the unsurpassed scourge of humankind. It's existed, it's followed and shadowed the evolutionary line of humans and the great apes, and it's been with us throughout our odyssey. So it's been the paramount killer, And then when yellow fever shows up later, regionally, yellow fever is also a huge killer, especially when we look at the colonial tropics in the Americas with European colonization in the Caribbean and Central America and certain spots in the southern U.S. Mind you, Philadelphia itself, when it was the capital, was ravaged by a yellow fever epidemic in 1793. And yellow fever epidemics are recorded as far north as Quebec City and Halifax in Canada. So yellow fever does rear its head in the colonies of the Americas.
So with malaria, though, an interesting situation with malaria research. What do you find in the way of funding for malaria research?
Well, first, even though there's a wide range of statistics on malaria rates and death rates from malaria annually, it's quite a wide swath. But even within that wide swath, when we look at malaria rates, both how many people are being infected with malaria, but also death rates, over the last 10 years, they are being reduced. No question that malaria rates are being reduced. But at the same time, what we're seeing is the emergence or reemergence of other mosquito-borne diseases. So, for example, we're seeing a big resurgence of dengue. And there's even been domestic cases of dengue transmission in the southern United States recently. And then obviously with West Nile and Zika in the United States, in southern Canada has West Nile as well, making the pages. So these aren't prolific killers, thankfully. I'm not saying anybody wants to acquire one of these diseases from a mosquito, but compared to malaria, these are not prolific killers. So overall, the mortality rate, if you will, from mosquito-borne disease is definitely lessening as international organizations and national organizations and NGOs are starting to put money into malaria research, whether that be the CDC, the World Health Organization, and certainly the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation has done noble service to try to curb malaria rates and the rates of other diseases.
Timothy Weingart is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is The Mosquito, A Human History of Our Deadliest Predator. You give an exploration in the book of sickle cell disease and tell us it's an adaptation to what?
To falciparum malaria, which is of the five human malaria species, that's the most lethal. So when the Bantu start clearing forest, jungle, to plant yams and plantains, they come face to face with falciparum malaria, which is a paramount killer. And very quickly, through natural selection, what develops is something called sickle cell trait or sickle cell disease, depending on the genetic makeup of how many you get from each parent. But what it does is provide nothing's 100%, but immunity to falciparum malaria. But at the same time, it happens very quickly, which is astounding, which just speaks to how lethal and how much of a threat falciparum malaria was to our species. But it happens so quickly, it's an imperfect genetic shield against malaria, because it ultimately takes lives as well. So sickle cell trait is essentially getting one sickle cell from one parent and not the other. And it generally, prior to modern medicine, would kill on average by the age of 23. But 23 is certainly long enough to live and procreate the human species. Now, sickle cell disease is where you get sickle cell from both parents, and essentially you've inherited a death sentence.
All right, but as you point out in the book, I mean, at a time when people didn't live very long, dying by sickle cell disease gave you at least a little more time than dying from malaria.
Right, you would survive, because malaria predominantly kills children under five, so obviously they can't procreate, so you could survive malaria to live long enough to procreate and pass on the sickle cell. So 25, so if you do the math on sickle cell, you'd have 50% with sickle cell trait, 25% with no sickle cell at all, and then 25% with the double sickle cell. So, but you're still living long enough to carry on your lineage.
Where again, our guest is Timothy Weingart on the Jefferson Exchange, a professor of history and political science at Colorado Mesa University in Grand Junction. He wrote a couple of previous books on his specialty areas, military history and indigenous studies, and faced the mosquito each time as a perpetrator of disease upon human populations as a hinge point in history. The mosquito has changed history several times. We'll talk about that in just a moment. His book is called The Mosquito, A Human History of Our Deadliest Predator. You're welcome to ask questions and make some comments about the situation on the exchange. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So let's dive into some of this history. So what killed Alexander the Great?
Well, we can't be definitive because he's missing in action. His body seemingly vanished from Alexandria at some point. But all information that we have, the best guess, and that's most often quoted and researched, is that he died of malaria. There's other theories that are out there, but and as I said, we'll never be 100% for sure unless we find him, which is highly doubtful. But certainly the consensus is malaria.
All right, and so that stopped his campaign into India. I can see why somebody who was ailing from malaria would say, you know what, I'm not going there. Hannibal, as you point out, led the Carthaginians into victory against the Roman army, and mosquitoes stopped him as well?
Well, the Pontine marshes that have historically surrounded Rome were a malarial hotbed throughout history, so Hannibal actually never tries to attack Rome itself, and there's various reasons for that, and that he operated, his tactics were quick-strike maneuver warfare. He didn't have siege weapons. He wasn't prepared to lay siege. But at the same time, the approaches to Rome and any siege grounds would have embedded Hannibal directly in the malarious Pontine marshes, something that he wasn't willing to do. And throughout history, when we look at the Pontine marshes, whether it's certainly the Carthaginians, but also the Visigoths, the Huns, the Vandals, the Pontine marshes act as a malaria shield, essentially, for the eternal city of Rome.
And a third example here, I kind of chuckled at your mention of secular mosquitoes, but how did mosquitoes help the spread of Christianity?
Well, certainly mosquitoes were not the only stimulus for the spread of Christianity, but they did act as one of the stimuli. Again, via the Pontine marshes in the malarial hotbed that was not only the Pontine marshes, but all of Italy. So unlike the polytheistic faiths, part of Christianity was a slow process, obviously, during its first few hundred years. It didn't take the world by storm in the way that Islam did. It was still a relatively persecuted and minority faith, even a few hundred years after the crucifixion of Jesus. So Christians regarded the healing and care of the sick almost as a sacramental and a duty of faith. So in Rome, they set up the first true hospitals, and people were attracted to Christianity because of the endemic malaria that was essentially encompassing and enveloping Rome. So it attracted converts as a remedial faith and a faith of caring and healing.
So then, to flip things around, Timothy, can you find many major history turning points not affected by mosquitoes?
Oh, sure. There's obviously not all of history has been, you know, guided by the mosquito, because certainly in some of the more Nordic countries, these diseases didn't exist, or they were very sporadic, such as Canada, for example. But even Canada has been affected. But and when we look at the Norse and the expansion of the Norse, there's not a lot of influence from the mosquito that we know of, or that is recorded in the Norse documentation or you know, subsequent research. So certainly the mosquito hasn't affected all of human history. That would be very historically reckless of me to say that, and I don't say that, but there are specific events like the American Revolution, like the Civil War, like the rise and fall of the Roman Empire, where we can clearly see from the primary sources in the historical record that the mosquito absolutely did inject her will and influence in those episodes of history.
We haven't even crossed the Atlantic yet, really. Did exploration of the New World bring mosquitoes to it? There were mosquitoes here already, weren't there?
Yes, so the Anopheles mosquito, certain species of the Anopheles transmit malaria, and then the Aedes mosquito transmits the catalog of viruses as well as the Culex mosquito. So when the continental shifts in the Earth's landmass happens, the Anopheles mosquitoes of the Americas essentially follow an isolated evolutionary projection for 90 to 95 million years, where they're free of burdening, free of the burden of vectoring malaria, whereas the old world mosquitoes, if you will, were the malaria, Anopheles were the malaria vectors. So when there's, as far as we know, perhaps syphilis is the only disease that went from the Americas to Europe, but all of these diseases didn't exist in the Americas and with the 100 million or so odd indigenous peoples who lived here, and that includes smallpox and tuberculosis and, you know, the whole swarm of European diseases. So when the first Europeans arrive, they have malaria in their blood, and the American Anopheles mosquitoes very quickly or immediately start being able to vector or do vector malaria, which infects not only the Europeans who brought it, but also the indigenous peoples of the Americas. And then when the slave trade really starts and gets kicked into high gear, which is obviously a horrible episode in our human history, the African slaves bring over yellow fever in their blood as well, but also Aedes mosquitoes hitchhike on boats and come to the Americas and quickly adapt to their new surroundings and start vectoring yellow fever as well.
Well, did the colonization of the Americas and the sickle cell disease, I mean, did sickle cell make Africans attractive for slave labor?
Well, there's more genetic malaria defenses than just sickle cell. There's Duffy antigen negativity. There's thalassemia. There's quite a few of them. So what was noticeable is that to European plantation owners, and whether this was a justification for slavery or it was noticeable, is that the European, certainly the indigenous, you know, African slave labor only became economically viable after the near destruction of indigenous populations. It costs more to import a slave than a local one right here. But with the near extinction, the decimation of indigenous peoples in the Americas, they weren't a viable option for slave labor anymore. And European indentured servants who were brought over were dying of yellow fever and malaria in the, you know, the mosquito-stoked furnace of the tropics. So Africans who had some genetic immunity to malaria, not all, but some had genetic immunity, or they had already contracted yellow fever and survived in Africa, thereby making them immune, were seen as a viable and profitable replacement for indigenous slave labor and also European indentured servants.
Wow. The mind boggles at this point in the book. Let's talk about practices that encourage mosquitoes to hang around. You mentioned that agriculture contributes to the growth of mosquito populations.
I think the quote in the book, I think it said, cultivation was shackled to a corpse. pestilence follows the plow. This can be, you can use the same analogy, whether it's the Panama Canal or even the Rideau Canal in Canada. When they were building that, malaria went on a rampage. When you start churning up the soil, digging trenches, clear-cutting forests, and then you add water where mosquitoes lay their eggs and breed, that's a dangerous recipe.
You mentioned early in the book about the very different attitudes toward chrysanthemums in the North and South in the United States, and this also comes back to a mosquito story. Tell us that one, Timothy.
Chrysanthemums are the very first insecticide coming out of China and then Persia, called the Persian powder, pyrethrins or pyrethrum. So you dry them and ground them and either use powdered form or mix with water, oil, and spray. So where mosquito-borne disease was fairly prevalent, And you use chrysanthemums for this purpose. They're not really seen as a celebratory flower for the most part. They were seen more as a funeral offering or had a negative connotation, whereas in places where there was, you know, limited or no mosquito-borne disease, they're seen as a festive and more joyous occasion flower.
Let's take a phone call here. We have Vince in Eugene on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hi there. I just wanted to relate a story and get some feedback from your guests. I was a Peace Corps volunteer in Colombia, and on one of our breaks with three friends, we went to the west coast of Colombia. We were going to stay in a town right by a beautiful beach, and it was a spectacular beach and virtually nobody on it. And they decided to sleep in a tent on the beach and have a back problem, so I decided to stay in town with all our stuff in the hotel. And eventually, we discovered they all three came down with malaria. And at the time, the Peace Corps was giving volunteers, I think it was called gamma globulin or something like that. Is there anything historically that, you know, really does prevent people from getting malaria?
All right, we'll check it out. Thanks for the question, Vince.
That's a good question, Vince. And I mean, people throughout history have tried various remedies to combat malaria. The ancient Egyptians bathed in fresh human urine, and now thankfully we don't have to do that anymore. They also wore an amulet with the magic word abracadabra around their necks. So there's been a host of things we've tried. Now, quinine in the British vernacular was the first successful anti-malarial. We still didn't know what caused malaria, but we knew this worked. The problem is malaria is such a sophisticated parasite that it adapts very quickly. So in modern times, chloroquine did work, certainly. But by the time we release and test these drugs in the actual populations and expose the parasite to these drugs, by the time they're mass marketed, the malaria parasite has adapted and evolved to be able to resist these continuous or successive line of anti-malarials. So they only work and last for a short period of time before the malaria parasite makes them obsolete. So that's one of the problems in combating malaria, is that it adapts so quickly to our best drugs. And the other problem is it's not a virus, it's a parasite, and a very sophisticated parasite. So vaccines, in the true sense of vaccines, like smallpox, which is a virus, don't work. So that's why it still exists, and that's why it's such a prevalent killer to this day, unfortunately, of human beings, is that it's just such an adaptive and remarkable creature that it circumvents the best drugs we can throw its way.
It's almost a super bug, then, in the sense that it's so adaptive to defeating the things that are sent out to destroy it.
Right. It works. Things work for a while, and then, as I said, it builds up a tolerance, or it adapts. So those frontline drugs, as soon as it gets exposed, it starts to say, oh, wait a minute here, this is something new, and I need to be able to circumvent this or beat this. And we've seen that throughout history with certainly quinine and then chloroquine, mefloquine. So that's why it's still so difficult to eradicate malaria, and why, you know, we're trying other avenues with CRISPR genetic genome altering technology, or we're trying to use some bacteria for dengue, for example, inject bacteria into a mosquito to stop it being able to transmit dengue. So that's why it's still such a prevalent killer, unfortunately.
We have a question somebody just dropped off about, talk about how mosquitoes and malaria affected the construction of the Panama Canal.
Predominantly, the Panama Canal was yellow fever, mm-hmm. But also malaria. So coming out of the Spanish-American War in Cuba, and Dr. Walter Reed and Carlos Finley, a Cuban scientist, identifying the mosquito as the cause of yellow fever, we quickly understood that we need to tackle, there was no vaccine for yellow fever yet, that's the 1930s. But we quickly tried to eradicate the mosquitoes that are transmitting the yellow fever, and it's successful in Cuba, and then we bring that technology from Cuba to the construction of the Panama Canal, and essentially with the help of quinine as well. There's quinine stations set up throughout the canal zone, and we eradicate the, for the most part, the mosquitoes that are causing or vectoring malaria and specifically yellow fever. So where the French had failed, tried and failed, the Spanish had tried and failed, the British had tried and failed, the Americans are successful in building the Panama Canal in part because of the steps made by Walter Reed.
I remember this from film strips in elementary school, though. Part of the deal was to pour oil onto ponds where the mosquitoes would breed, didn't we?
Right. So it was various uses of insecticide and oil and spraying and clear cutting back different types of specifically targeted bushes and trees to try to make at least the canal zone proper, free from the mosquitoes that transmit yellow fever.
So, Timothy, you were talking earlier about the parts of the world that don't have malaria and therefore don't have real mosquito issues like the Scandinavian countries. But take us back to Europe, not quite as far north. You write of a malaria belt in England. Where's that?
So the eastern counties of England, centered on Kent, so east of east and then northeast of London, so that east coast of England, and called the Fens or the Fenlands, were another regional zone like the Pontine Marshes or parts of the Danube River, where there is a malaria hotbed in the Fenlands. And so we see in, you know, Great Expectations, it's mentioned by Charles Dickens. There's frequent, Shakespeare mentions them, you know, Geoffrey Chaucer in Canterbury Tales, there's frequent mention in English literature of these Fens or Fenlands. And so a lot of settlers with the high malaria rates in the Fenlands, and these were the poor and relatively landless who lived there, because these are marshes, they moved further afield. So they moved to Ireland, for example, in Northern Ireland, and set up plantations, as they're called, in Northern Ireland, which led to the Troubles and the violence in Northern Ireland. And a lot of them were among the first English colonists to come to the Americas as well, which is why they brought malaria with them from these Fenlands in England.
Well, the plantation of Ireland would have happened anyway, wouldn't it? I mean, England wanted loyalists there on the countryside.
Yes, but it's these specifically, these people had, they were a bit predominantly, a lot of them that went came from these malarial Fenlands because there was a better opportunity in Ireland than it was in, well, staying in the marshes of the Fens in England.
Mm-hmm. Have there been some mass abandonments of European outposts in the New World because of mosquito-borne diseases?
The story that I found particularly fascinating was the attempts of the Scottish to create their own colonies in the Americas. So Scotland was its own country, and it was independent from England. And in the late 1600s, it was coming out of a recession and famine. And in order to kind of boost Scotland's fortunes in future, between a quarter and half the money available money in Scotland was put into this Darien venture, which was to create a Scottish colony in Panama. And so boatloads of Scottish with all this capital went over to set up this colony, and they were absolutely crushed by mosquito-borne disease, and the colony floundered and failed miserably, and it left Scotland in huge debt. So England offered to repay the Scottish debt if Scotland would forfeit its sovereignty and be annexed to England with the Act of Union.
So the Act of Union under, this is James I, is that when, or was it later than that?
1707.
Okay, yeah, okay, later then, wow. So Scotland lost its sovereignty in part because of malaria.
Because of the mosquitoes of Panama,
wow.
Yes. It's an amazing story. But again, what it goes to show is just how small our world, I suppose, or our history really is, and we do indeed live in a global village where mosquito-borne disease is a universal problem. It's not something that's confined to, you know, very regionally, and it requires a universal solution in a way.
You had mentioned earlier some of the things that that we have done to try to ward off mosquitoes. Generally, we talked about external treatments. There's a lot of stuff we have eaten and drunk over the years to ward off mosquitoes. But at one point, opium was touted as an anti-malarial drug?
Well, yes, but in a sort of very shady way. The British used the high malarial rates in India and China to support their, to justify the trade in opium. And obviously, they touted it as a cure for opium and that it was their duty to provide the Chinese and Indians with opium to help them. Now, it's quite a bit shady history. And obviously, once these people got hooked, they continued to smoke opium, no longer from trying to use it as a malarial supplement, which didn't work anyway, but because, you know, opium has their, has its claws in these people. So it's, again, a macabre piece of the mosquito's history in the British opium trade.
You've mentioned a couple times, Timothy, about some genetic modifications, and although I think we were focusing on the malaria parasite itself, but what do you make of the efforts to use CRISPR and some of the other technologies to change mosquitoes and blunt their impacts through genetic modification of the insects themselves?
Well, I'm a historian. I'm not an entomologist or a geneticist, but obviously, CRISPR technology is fascinating, and it, you know, since it's been unveiled in 2012, it's made media headlines ever since, and it's certainly revolutionary. There's no question about that. To be able to you know, intrude on natural selection and manipulate the DNA and genome of any animal, including humans, is quite remarkable. So I think what the goal specifically with mosquitoes is. Keep in mind that not all mosquito species vector disease. So I don't think the goal here of any institution is to eradicate mosquitoes and undo the balance to the force, if you will. I think what the goal is to CRISPR mosquitoes to make them harmless. So CRISPR them to make them incapable of vectoring the disease, thereby eliminating the disease or diseases, but not to necessarily exterminate the mosquito itself.
In your own personal dealings with mosquitoes, which I can't imagine are that frequent in your part of Colorado, but they'll be there, I think. But so do you treat mosquitoes differently now after all this research?
Well, I'll say I'm from Canada originally. I'm born and raised in Canada, so mosquitoes are as generic to our culture as,
sure,
you know, hockey and Tim Hortons. So I'm definitely used to mosquitoes. And here in Grand Junction, where I moved about 7 years ago, we're in West Nile Alley here in Grand Junction, and they do spray for mosquitoes. We have our own mosquito control board and all of that. So they're a concern here actually with the West Nile. But yeah, I grew up being covered and swarmed by mosquitoes back home in Canada. But my appreciation for them, I mean, it's a tough question to answer because I find the mosquito a remarkable creature and such an adaptive creature to be able to survive the best, you know, we've thrown her way. But at the same time, we have this animal who's the paramount, you know, killer of human beings, and certainly nobody supports that or nobody, you know, you feel empathy for these people around the world who are being, you know, affected by mosquito-borne disease, and it is global, as we see in the U.S. with West Nile and Zika and now sporadic cases of dengue and chikungunya. So I'm torn in a way. I think we can appreciate the impact that she's had on human history without necessarily supporting what she does to human beings.
Right. Okay. The book is called The Mosquito, A Human History of Our Deadliest Predator. Timothy Weingard, the author, thank you so much for joining us on The Exchange today.
Thank you very much. And that-